From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Brad Besser's film, which premiered at Sundance last year, is a movie about a movie. Three movies, really, made and stitched together by the Salt Lake City iconoclast and filmmaker Trent Harris. And it all started with one miraculously serendipitous encounter in a parking lot 37 years ago. Trent had a camera with him when he met this young man from Beaver, Utah, who was an innocent, kind of guileless, and he had this dream. He wanted to perform, be on TV. The story has some touching and gut-wrenching turns, and Trent made three attempts to get it right. The Beaver Trilogy, as it's now known, has become a kind of underground cult classic, and Besser's film is the story behind it. We're screening the film next week as part of our documentary series. Besser will be with us today to talk about the Beaver Trilogy, Part 4, after the news.
KUER's volunteers give their time year-round to lend a helping hand. Our volunteers staff booths at special events, help with paperwork in our membership department, and assist the news and Radio West teams with behind-the-scenes details. Maybe you're a photographer or a graphic designer and you'd like to volunteer your skills. Or you have some spare time that you'd like to donate. We're always grateful for a little extra help from our friends. Find out more about volunteer opportunities at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Many of us who have seen Trent Harris's film, The Beaver Trilogy, were always left wondering what really happened to the kid in that story. And don't worry, if you don't know anything about the film, we'll get you caught up here in just a moment. Basically, this is about a young man Trent Harris met in a parking lot in Salt Lake City 37 years ago when he was testing out a video camera. And there was something about the kid for Trent Harris. He was from Beaver. He was quirky and funny in a self-conscious kind of way. And Trent became kind of obsessed with his naive dream about making it in show business. Trent Harris made three versions of this story. Part two and part three were just fictional retellings of the original one, a documentary, basically, about the kid's performance at a talent show back in Beaver. Brad Besser had his own obsession with the story when he saw the Beaver Trilogy, and the film he made, which he describes as a movie about a movie, picks up the story. But it's also, in some ways, a profile of Trent Harris. It's about art and mixed motives and reality. Besser's film, which premiered at Sundance last year, is called The Beaver Trilogy, Part 4. We're going to be screening it next week as part of our documentary series. We'll give you details about that a little bit later. But Brad is joining us today to talk about it. Brad is a Salt Lake Valley native, directed the film Beaver Trilogy, Part 4, which I said premiered at Sundance last year. And we'll give you the details about that later in the program. Brad is joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. And Brad Besser, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
Okay, so I want to jump in. I gave a sort of thumbnail sketch of the story, but you really lay out the story behind the story. Trent's meeting with this young man. Can you just say something about, before we say anything about that, the kind of moment of serendipity, you know, because it kind of comes up in the film from time to time that it's this sort of kind of brilliant miracle of fate that this thing happens when it happens. You want to say something about that because it's really interesting, the kind of serendipity of it, like this is this perfect moment that just he happens to stumble upon.
Yeah, sure. So I think Trent is a very good, he observes very well. So what to most people seems like a strange thing, and even today I try and explain the film, it's about a local cameraman in Salt Lake City testing out a camera, and he finds an interesting guy in the parking lot.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like it would be like the premise of what I feel is like one of the greatest films ever. I mean, I think any person who wants to get into the film biz should watch Beaver Trilogy,
because
it's all about following your dream. And so it's one of those things that Trent just, he saw something that somebody, not everybody would pick up on, and followed it to a place where most people wouldn't go with it, and uncovered something that I think, you know, especially the footage of the kid in the parking lot, it's him doing his impressions of John Wayne and Rocky. And it's just kind of this amazing Gray Gardens, really special yeah. piece of footage.
Yeah. Let me play that moment, of course, actually, because I want people to get a sense of what this person sounds like and the interaction and just kind of what Trent encountered. As you said, as he steps out into the parking lot to try he's at KUTV at the time, and they had been shooting everything on film before that, but they have this new video camera, and Trent goes into the parking lot to check it out, and this is what he finds.
You hang on to this.
Is this really going over TV right now?
Uh-huh.
It is.
John Wayne in the page.
Are you kidding? Well, how about that? John Wayne, here, Mom. Here's John Wayne. Yo. Well, I'll tell you something out there in TV land. I'm hamming it up. I'll tell you.
Can you do any more imitations?
Do you know Rocky? Sylvester Stallone?
Yeah, do that one.
Okay, you know what I mean? You know Rocky, Sylvester Stallone, you know? He's got a coach named Mickey. You know what I mean? He's a good guy, you know? He knows his fight. He knows his left from his right. He knows his left toe from his right toe, you know? He's a good fighter, you know? He's a good guy, and he loves his wife, Adrian, you know? So, anyway... I love it up here, though. I was just taking some pictures of Sky 2 over there, and, man, it's really fantastic out here. I love it. I love it up here. I love impersonating, and, by gosh, if I made the tube, I'd just thank you so much.
What's Trent's reaction to this guy? Because you've talked to him about this a lot. What does he figure he's seeing?
Oh, good question. I think, I think... that at the time that Trent was working at this at KUTV, but he's working for the show called Extra, yeah. which did kind of a little bit more off the wall kind of pieces. So I think that he was kind of looking for that kind of you can hear in Groove and Gary. So the kid's name is yeah. he goes by Groove and Gary,
right.
And he's got that just kind of an amazing laugh and this amazing kind of. This like radiating personality. I mean that he, after that moment, he goes over and he shows Trent his car, and his car is this kind of like really amazing. It's this, I can't remember the model of it, but it's got red interior. It's got this Bigfoot gas pedal. It's got, it's got these etchings of Farrah Fawcett and Olivia Newton-John. And you can tell that he's kind of this really, strange, but, at the same time, you know, he just that interaction kind of, I think, left Trent wanting more and wondering, you know, who this kid really is, because he just got a small glimpse. And that glimpse, you know, was, I think, you know, it's hilarious and just engrossing.
Yeah. Engrossing is right. For some weird reason. It's like, what is it about this guy? And so Trent sort of follows him. And then there's this talent show. He calls Trent up and says he's going to be putting on a talent show, Groove and Gary does, and he wants him to come down. And this is where, and maybe we should say something initially, we'll talk more about motive as we go, but this is where the story gets complicated in the sense that because there's always this question, Brad, about who's manipulating whom, like who's exploiting whom. You know,
for sure.
Groove yeah. and Gary wants some attention. He wants these guys to come down and do something with him. Trent wants something from Gary, obviously. So Trent and the film crew, they go KUTV, they go down to Beaver to this the
yeah,
day of
so
this talent show.
The Beaver kid, Groove and Gary, he continues to send letters to Trent. I think, you know, through their brief interaction in the parking lot, I think the whole reason Groove and Gary was up there was because he wanted to be on TV.
Yeah.
So he wanted to be on TV. He wanted to just kind of, even if he wasn't on TV, I think he wanted to be, you know, behind the camera. I think he wanted to do, he just wanted to be in television because he just loved television so much. So he kind of would continue to send these letters to Trent and phone calls, and he would invite Trent down so that maybe they could do an Extra piece. And Extra was known for doing some kind of strange pieces. Mm-hmm. I uncovered a number of great pieces where for one piece they sent Trent up to do a online dating in Idaho, and it's like a 7-minute piece, and he doesn't even go on a date. He's just wandering around Idaho, and it's kind of this like very free form kind of journalism that you would never see. So I think that kind of also sparked the kid's interest that maybe these guys would come down and they would, you know, do this talent show. They'd put him on TV, and maybe that would be his big break.
You know, I have to say that was, I think for people who grew up here, seeing those that those images from the old Extra show was really fun. And it was kind of reminded me how kind of remarkable that show was. For, I mean, Lucky Severson was sort of the main reporter, and they were letting Trent shoot this stuff. And, you know, for those who know Trent Harris, he's got an incredible storytelling technique. He's really quirky, and it was pretty amazing for its time, if you think about it, that show.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, I in talking with Trent, he even, you know, echoed that he couldn't believe that they would hire him, and that they would allow him to do the kind of stories he was doing. And so, basically, I believe Extra sent him down to Beaver so that he could basically videotape a local talent show in Beaver as possibly a story for the news.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, it's like kind of mind-boggling that they would put those resources into something that seems so kind of small and insignificant.
Yeah. Here's another moment. This is Trent shooting a Groovin Gary at, this is such a great detail, he goes to the town mortuary to get his makeup done because he is going to, and maybe you should set this up, Brad, of all the impressions that he can do, and he has a big arsenal of them. You heard Rocky there. You heard John Wayne. He decides to do Olivia Newton-John in a small town, which means he has to put on a wig and get made up to look like a woman. And this is where the thing gets kind of weird here. But do you want to say something about this moment? He's at the mortuary here, and this story is starting to unfold, and it's a little stranger, I think, than some people may have thought.
Yeah, the charisma and the draw from the parking lot is still there. You know, he's got that kind of goofy laugh, and but you can see that he's a little bit more hesitant. And as I got to this, the story was kind of unfolding for me. That really was one of the main reasons I wanted to make the movie, was so that I could find out, you know, what were his motives and who was this kid.
Yeah.
I think he just thought it was, you know, so off the wall that it would be that kind of funny thing that maybe these goofy guys in Salt Lake might come down and do if you did something that really, you know, pushed the envelope. And I think he just got it in his mind that he was going to do it, and he did it. And it's so funny that he was at the mortuary of all, the mortician seemed the only person in the town that was able to do his makeup so that he'd look like Olivia Newton-John. And while I think she had a good effort, he looked nothing like Olivia Newton-John. The hair was wrong. The makeup was wrong. Even the outfit, I think, wasn't quite right. But, it's more of the idea of now this character who was this funny kid in a parking lot is now dressed up in full drag and ready to perform an Olivia Newton-John song in Beaver, Utah in 1979.
Okay, this is... I still am a man. I'm doing outrageous things, but I enjoy being a guy. I really do.
That convinces. But
yes, I do. I've got to convince the audience that I have not gone crazy. It's just for fun.
There comes a time when you're filming people, when you're doing documentaries, and often what happens is they will say one thing, but the information you're picking up is something completely different. There's a subtext going on, and the subtext can, you know, if you can catch that subtext, it's fascinating. And I felt like I was getting a lot of that kind of subtext. This whole piece is filled with that sort of thing.
There's a moment, Brad, that Trent and the other filmmakers there with KUTV shoot when he's singing, when he actually goes on stage and sings. And I have to say, I'd never noticed it before. Maybe I should have in the past. But he looks kind of terrified and regretful, and you think there's a moment when he's thinking, "No, this is dumb. This is a bad idea." But I've never really noticed the kind of terror. It seemed like to me, kind of terror in his eyes. Did you notice that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when he's on stage, you can get there's a few kind of. You know, when he's getting his makeup done, the mortician's putting on his makeup, and he's talking about, you know, I'm still a man, I'm just doing this for fun kind of thing. There's a few of those kind of like nuggets that are mixed in just kind of regular conversation. But when he gets the very first piano note for the song that they perform, he has this look in his eye that's I would say it's pure terror. And it's partially terror because now he's on stage and he's finally getting to do what he wanted to do and the cameras are there. And also Trent, you can tell just by the camera angle, Trent's probably less than a foot from his face. And everyone's watching, you know, the town is there and they're all judging him. And I think that you can see his eyes tell you everything that that he was a little bit scared in that moment.
Yeah. And now the question comes up as you start to unfold the story in the film. What was Trent trying to do? Because then you have reactions from like one of the cameramen, Greg Sumner, is a really well respected cameraman in the city. And Diane Orr, who was a producer for the Extra program at the time, they were having these conversations about what is this stuff that you guys collected, and should we even show this as part of Extra? Are you exploiting this kid? I mean, what were the questions? What were the conversations that came up? Because in the end, they decided not to run it.
Yeah, and that was kind of the fun part for me was this kind of like investigation, because I started with Trent, but then I started interviewing a lot of other people, and a lot of people had a different take on it. I think Diane Orr described it as, maybe the kid was trying to tell something to the world that he didn't even realize he was trying to tell to the world. I think that that maybe she thought he was gay, and maybe that the people in Beaver might have thought he was gay, but that he actually wasn't gay. He was just trying to kind of do something wild. And I mean, there's all kinds of like interpretations of what his motives were.
Right.
I think they just couldn't run it. And it was almost too strange for television, if that makes any.
Even
it was
for
too
extra.
Strange for the strange. Yeah, it was too strange for the strange station that was putting on all these strange stories. And that one was the one that just pushed it too far.
Yeah. When you first saw Beaver Trilogy, when was it? You saw it in the three forms, right? In the when Trent had stitched it all together, yeah?
Originally I saw it. So growing up, I had a friend of mine gave me a VHS tape of Reuben and Ed, which is another one of Trent's films, which is probably his most well-known film, starring Crispin Glover and Howard Hessman and Karen Black. And it's, I thought it was hilarious. And, you know, I'd always go around with my friends and we'd say, my cat can eat a whole watermelon, which is one of the kind of iconic lines from the movie. It's a very screwball kind of comedy, but it was shot. I mean, it's a $1 million film. It was shot, in Hollywood or with Hollywood's backing. And, you know, when you're a kid, you've just got I've got VHS collection. I don't know that Dumb and Dumber was a success and that Reuben Ed was a huge failure. I just see them as like those must be great movies because I have them and I like them. So that they must be great for that reason. And so I always thought of Trent as this kind of, larger than life. Here was a man, you know, I'm originally from Salt Lake and I wanted to make films, and here was a guy that did it. So, you know, I took his classes at the Utah Film and Video Center, and in those classes, he showed us these three short films that he had done. And first he showed us the documentary of the kid in the parking lot. And then he showed us the subsequent films. And, and then eventually put those three films together and called it the Beaver Trilogy. And it was, just one of the most fascinating, films I've ever seen. And I'm still, even after spending the last 5 years making this documentary, I'm still fascinated by it.
Why do you think it's, because that's a huge question. What is it about that film that fascinates so many of us? Because in many ways, and I get why Trent hates talking about it. Like, I don't want it seems like he's saying, I'm a filmmaker and I do art and I don't want to be defined by this one moment in a parking lot nearly 40 years ago. But there's something about it. What do you think it is? Do you think you figured it out after all this time now?
Absolutely not. And the thing is I think that different people interpret it different ways, yeah. Which is kind of the beauty of it, is that in Trent's presentation, all Trent did was just put his three films. So he made these three films, but didn't show them to anybody. And then he just put these three films together, back to back to back, with a little bit of black in between, and said nothing about them. And you just have a million questions. You know, who's that? Who's the kid in the first one? And why did he make these? And it's like I think that's part of it too. And I think for me, why I latched onto it so hard, and maybe this is why, the same reason that other people do, is because you could see it's a very simple journey of a kid who wants to follow his dreams and get on television.
Yeah.
And in, you know, doing that, he takes kind of a different turn. Yeah.
He maybe goes too far almost.
Yeah, he goes too far and kind of ruins his dream, or, you know, but it's still that the heart of having a dream and being able to go after it, which is maybe something, you know, that growing up in Salt Lake City, I probably had similar dreams, but didn't quite know the path to go.
Yeah. Brad Besser is with us. He directed the new documentary film Beaver Trilogy Part 4. You can see it free next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of filmmaker Trent Harris's cult classic, The Beaver Trilogy. A lot of you have heard of it or seen it. You may know Trent. He lives here in Salt Lake. And in 1979, he worked for the TV news station KUTV. He was in a parking lot testing out a new video camera when he came across this remarkable young man from Beaver, Utah. That's where the story starts. And it goes all over the place, as Brad Besser explores in his new film called Beaver Trilogy Part 4, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival last year. We're going to be screening that film next week on Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, and you can get details about that on our website. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. Brad's in London right now. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC. So I want to ask about Trent's reluctance to say too much about what really happens in the story. And there's this great moment, and I want to play this moment. Trent is having a conversation. Starlee Kine is doing this piece for the radio program, This American Life, and she's talking to Trent about this story. And he doesn't want to say too much. And it's sort of getting me to this question of how much he was willing to say to you, and what his reluctance was about what actually takes place in the story. And we'll sort of lay this out here in a moment. But I'm not sure if we need to say anything more, Brad. This is a conversation, an interview that Trent is having with Starlee Kine. Do you want to say anything about this moment?
Well, the hard thing was is that Trent didn't want to talk too much. So I had to rely on other people and other interviews and a lot of other footage to kind of, you know, put it all together. And this was just one of those pieces that kind of helped me put it all together.
And what she's trying to get at here, Starlee, is there's, in part two and part three, it's revealed that this kid is attempting, he attempts suicide because he's humiliated. And he makes this phone call, and he calls the producer, he calls this Trent Harris character to try to talk him out of airing it. Like, I was humiliated. Please don't put that on the TV. That can be bad.
Yeah. And what it is it's in the first documentary, he does the parking lot, there's the Olivia Newton-John, and in the second pieces, Trent basically kind of remakes the story, and he remakes it kind of, he just sticks to the story. He doesn't kind of fabricate a lot of things. But the thing that he does fabricate is is at the very end, there's a phone call where the character says, I don't want this to be on TV. And then there's the kid in the second two remakes puts a gun in his mouth and, you know, is on the verge of suicide.
Right. Okay, let's stop there.
So why would he do that?
So why would he do that? Exactly. And that's what Starlee Kine wants to know. And Trent's just not going there with her, as you can hear in this this conversation. This is from Brad Besser's film, The Beaver Trilogy, Part 4.
So, and this is not based on anything, right? It actually happened.
No, it's something I fabricated.
So
something I made up.
Why?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I mean, really, what's this move? Why don't you shut up?
And finally, I just told her to shut up.
I mean, he just told me to shut up, and he, like, was getting annoyed that I kept at him. Although I think I was right, too, because I think he admits to feeling it being a different thing.
How to put this? I did get a phone call after I had been in Beaver, and the phone call said, listen, I've been thinking about that. Maybe, you know, maybe you shouldn't put it on TV.
Oh, it was horrible. I hated that interview. It went on and on and on, almost as long as this one.
I love that point. And it sort of reveals. Now, that must have been difficult. And let's say Trent finally does come clean that this, and I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this, but this is a part of the actual story. But he doesn't want to talk about it. What can you say about that? What would he say? What did you finally get him to say? What can you say about that at this point?
Well, it was this whole film. I mean, it really was kind of an obsession of mine because I wanted to know, you know, what really happened? Why did he make three films and what happened to the original kid?
Yeah.
So I approached Trent about it. I didn't tell him exactly what I was going to do. And I actually didn't tell him exactly what I was going to do until about 2 weeks before it premiered at Sundance.
Wow.
Just because I knew 10 minutes into our first interview, I started asking him kind of the typical questions that you would ask Trent Harris, because, you know, the same people would love that loved Beaver Trilogy just like me would be asking him.
Yeah.
And he saw exactly where it was going and said, he probably said five times in that first interview that he didn't really want to talk about the Beaver Trilogy. He really wanted to talk about his new film Luna Mesa. He wanted to talk about, you know, the process of making film. And I knew at that point it was going to be a little bit difficult to kind of get the film that I wanted to get, but I just continued to follow him, and I'd ask him 30 questions, and there'd be that one moment where I could ask him something about the Beaver Trilogy because it had something to do with what we were talking about, and he'd give me a little more information and a little more information. And but that, I think, was really valuable too in what I was trying to do was who is this guy and why did he do these three films? And I think once you get to know who Trent Harris is, that it is pretty obvious, you know, why he did it and what he's, you know, that the kind of person that would put these three films together in a very kind of almost, I don't know, it was almost like a contemporary art museum film, kind of the way he just slapped them together. And then there's the Beaver Trilogy.
Yeah. You know, to me, a big question has always been, and I've asked him this, by the way, I've also given it a shot. Did he make the second and third version of the story? Because these were stories that he wrote, right? He wrote scripts and he cast them famously with Sean Penn in one, part two, and Crispin Glover, part three. And did he make those second and third versions of the story to further explore the pathos in that character? Because he often talked about how, and he says this in your film, I don't think people got it. Like, they didn't see what I was seeing. There was something beautiful in that story. And so he was frustrated that Extra didn't want to run it. He didn't think people were getting it. So there's that. But then there's the other motive of, was he also trying to redeem his own kind of distorted motive? You know, because it's interesting, and I want to play a moment. This is from Beaver Part 2. This is the Sean Penn one. And he maybe we should say this, Brad. He recasts his own character as this really mean, manipulative guy who's just after exploitation right?
Yeah, and that's, I guess, that's the other part. You know, he's very faithful to the first documentary, but he's also, he has these few things, and he recasts himself, and gives himself kind of the villain motive,
yeah,
and also these kind of that scene at the end. So it's kind of those two things that are really the question about, you know, what were his actual goals, and were they as villainous as he portrays them in the second two remakes?
Yeah. Here's a moment from Beaver 2. This is after the Beaver Kid has, you know, sort of humiliated himself on stage, and he's confronted by an acquaintance backstage.
You made a fool out of yourself out there.
No, it's small time, I know, but people start calling me.
Take that silly wig off. Listen, those TV people aren't your friends. You know, people see that on television, they're not going to call. They're going to call you a fruit.
Is there any point trying to figure out what Trent was actually doing there? Has he ever come out and said it? Because I'm not sure it's entirely clear right now. It seems like it's a little bit of everything. He's trying to sort of – he had conflicted feelings about whether he should have – whether he did exploit this kid. Was he trying to redeem himself? Do you think it's clear now?
I think it's – the romantic view is that he was trying to, in a way, redeem himself – point out that what the kid was doing, trying to follow his dreams and even dressing up as Olivia Newton-John, that it wasn't a bad thing, that people just didn't understand that, and that it's not a bad thing to follow your dreams, and it's not a bad thing to fail and stumble along the way, that's kind of the part where you realize that, you know, you don't want that dream anymore, or that you want to continue to pursue that dream. Mm-hmm. I would say that's the romantic interpretation. I also think, without Trent telling me this specifically, that it was just something that Trent was really fascinated by. Yeah. And it was kind of I think it was a bit of a shock to him, and it was something that he couldn't get out of his head, so he wanted to continue to remake it. And he also knew that he had kind of an amazing character, and that to continue to explore these things probably would be an interesting path to go down. And also, I guess maybe to back up a little bit, While we're trying to understand who the Beaver Kid is, and this is something that I started to understand while making the film, is that Trent he wasn't necessarily the bad guy. He wasn't the guy that was kind of this villainous exploiter of this kind of kid who didn't know any better. Trent really is, I think, the kid in a way. He had his own dreams. You know, he wanted to go off to Hollywood, and he kind of had the same aspirations. Both of them had the same aspirations. I have the same aspirations. Sean Penn probably had the same aspirations too. You know, it's all kind of that when you're a kid and you don't know any better and you just, you know, you're throwing it out there. And I think, in a way, the kid's story also helps Trent to, you know, realize that it's his own story. And boy, if Trent was here, he would just be on the floor laughing with that explanation.
No doubt about it. That is so true. Yeah, because I think that he doesn't like to talk about it in those terms either. And so I think it's fascinating. You got a lot out of him, I have to say, which I wondered if you would be able to. But it does seem like he's really connected to that story. And this is a theme in your film, this idea of the Hollywood dreamer. And I wonder
it wasn't obvious looking at the film, you know, watching the film and it took a lot of time for me to kind of understand that and process it. It took a lot of like conversations with people, screening the film for friends and family, and to, you know, kind of try to really understand. I understood the story. I understood that it starts in the first part, it goes to the second part, it goes to the third part, and then it, you know, it follows. But what was the theme of the film? And that was the thing that was, you know, it took a long time for me to kind of really understand that theme.
Brad Besser is with us, directed the documentary film Beaver Trilogy Part 4. Next Wednesday night, we're screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series. It's a partnership we have with the Utah Film Center. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with filmmaker Brad Besser. We're talking about his film Beaver Trilogy Part 4, which we're screening next week in Salt Lake City at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. So, and I don't want to give too much away. I want to be really careful here. But one of the things that you did, and I think a lot of people will be, I know I was, tickled with the idea that you went down to Beaver to see what happens to Groove and Gary. When you went down there, what did people – did people know this story? Because it seems like – I mean, you have the sense that, oh, it's got to be this infamous moment. But it doesn't seem like people remembered. They didn't even know what you were talking about.
Yeah, it was like I said earlier, this the film, I'm so surprised it was made because – first off, it was something that Trent didn't want to talk about, but also when I got to Beaver, I bet there was five people in the entire town of Beaver that had any idea what the Beaver Trilogy was, or that, you know, even in that town it was a secret. You know, the film was a secret. It was more well-known probably, you know, at film schools than it would be where it actually took place. And yeah, nobody knew, and not a lot of people. And the people that knew, they were a little bit hesitant to talk about it.
And particularly his family, which you found, and we'll leave some of that for people to come and see. But one of the things that some of his family members said was that what Trent did in that film, without sort of completing the arc of the story, was put a cap. This is how it was put by someone in the film to you. It put a cap on what Dick did. Like, it put a cap on his dream of going to Hollywood, because it humiliated him and he becomes a recluse. And what does Trent have to say about that? That idea go ahead, sorry.
That's probably why Trent doesn't want to talk about it too much, and that's probably where. So I think that Trent does feel guilt. Yeah. I think that he feels guilt that you know, things didn't go better, and you know, it's like it's a traumatic moment when you put all of your dreams, your hopes, your time, your money into something that it is a bit of a failure. So even though I think the kid really wanted, the kid was trying to get Trent down there. Mm-hmm. Trent was also looking for a story, and while he had a part in it, he probably didn't have as big a part in like exploiting the kid. And I think that, you know, I think he definitely felt bad about the way it went.
Yeah, here's Trent, in fact, talking about those kind of mixed motives that he's feeling about it from Brad Besser's film Beaver Trilogy Part 4.
I mean, it's a mixture of things. You feel guilty that I've exploited the guy, and then I'd think about that person. No, I didn't exploit him. He was exploiting me, actually, in a way. As I started to think of too, so I got over the guilt thing. But to take it to a step beyond that, I would have felt guilty, because then it becomes exploitive. And that's the trouble I was having when I kept remaking the damn thing. You know, I'm making the thing, but if I show it, it becomes exploitive. So I didn't show it. It was ridiculous. I did it secretly. I didn't want it to get out, because I didn't want it to come back, but I still wanted to do it, so I had to keep it a secret.
And it was a secret.
And about 5 seconds after that, Trent would say, he'd go over and start talking about something else. That was about as deep as I would be able to get with him, and yeah, as much as he would be able to admit to me.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I think that comes through, by the way, his reluctance really to deal with it. But then as the family tells you, actually, in the film, that they're hoping you, Brad Besser, will set the record straight. What did you make of that? Because that puts the onus on you in some ways. Were you reluctant to now take that responsibility? I mean, at first you're this guy, oh, I'm no, this observer. I want to tell this backstory to this quirky thing. And then all of a sudden the family's saying, no, 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 there's something deeper here you need to do.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, I knew that that was my in. That was actually about, I mean, we were filming probably, I don't know, for a few minutes. We needed to stop to change the tape. And but we had our recorder running in the background, and that's when we were changing the tapes. They kind of let us know that, you know, this is what we want you to do, and this is, you know, you can now, you know, put a cap on the story, and there is a cap that needs to be put on the story. And so I was just thrilled, because I was sure that it wasn't actually going to happen, and I knew at that moment that it was kind of like the door was open. I could ask the questions, and you know, this, it actually, you know, it might happen. They have a motive to kind of, you know, tell their story, to kind of fill in some of those gaps that Trent left out.
We got a comment from a person who didn't give us a last name of Steve. And they write, I've never forgiven Trent. He took Groove and Gary's story to Hollywood, tried to make it. He left Gary behind. He could have cast him in his show, but he never did. And Gary is way funnier than Penn or Glover, for example. Do you get that from time to time, that kind of resentment of what Trent did with that story or didn't do?
Well, the only thing that I mean, Trent was going to Hollywood to go follow his dreams. And I think that, you know, he could have probably, it would have been great to see if you could have cast him as something else. Actually, Trent told me when we weren't filming that Chris Smith from American Movie was also at Sundance the same year that Beaver Trilogy was at Sundance, and that Chris Smith was thinking about casting Gary in something because he was just so amazed kind of by the Beaver Trilogy. I think there was already too much history there to continue to turn it into something else. And also at that point when the Beaver Trilogy was released, it's like 2001, I believe, or it played at Sundance in 2001. Mm-hmm. And Trent was kind of on to different things. You know, he'd already done Reuben and Ed. He'd already done Plan 10, which were both big films, big achievements, but financial failures. And so he started doing small documentaries, and he's doing documentaries about Cambodia. He's doing documentaries about Sierra Leone. This kind of like world traveler, and, you know, trying to make something with, you know, again, with the Beaver Kid, you know, 25 or 30 years later. I can't do the math right now, but yeah, I just don't think it fit into where he was at that time.
Yeah.
This is all, of course, me speaking for Trent, so this could be completely out of line.
Yeah. Well, he has his own sort of way of sort of expressing his sense of all of that, as anyone who's talked to him knows, which is great. But I have to say that it's an important part of the film, because in many ways it's also a profile of him and his sense of art and his you know, you talk about surrealism, you talk about his affection for, you know, photography and painting and drawing, and his idea of randomness. And this is a really important one too, and I want to play this moment from the film. This idea, as he puts it early on, of listen to your visitors. A lesson that he relates to this great story that he tells about a woman he encounters at a 7-Eleven. Let me play this moment. This is Trent Harris from Brad Besser's film.
One morning I was sitting out over here at 7-Eleven. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm drinking a cup of coffee and smoking a cigarette, and I see this woman walk across the street. It is obviously homeless. She didn't have any shoes on, and she looks pretty fucked. looked up, and she comes walking by, and she says, "Can I have a cigarette?" I said, "Yeah." Anyway, she sits down and starts to talk to me. And it turns out she's the most wise person I've ever met in my entire life. She's got this incredible insight. So anyway, I call her my crack angel, and I learned this thing of listen to your visitors. You don't know. People are going to come by, and they're going to give you information that you would never, ever guess. You know, the conversations you get into with strangers, and sometimes they're quite profound, and you just need to be open to that kind of stuff. If I'd have said, "Yeah, fuck off, I'm not giving you a cigarette," I wouldn't have got any of that inspiration.
What did you learn about his process through all of that? Because, you know, that's kind of the way he seems to encounter the world, is just these chance encounters.
And the Beaver Trilogy makes so much more sense once you understand his kind of the way he looks at the world. I think he described this one time in a Q&A for his latest film, or what was his latest film at the time, Luna Mesa, yeah. That he was, if it feels good, do it. And I mean, it's kind of a weird way of it's not really like a very specific or a very artistic way of like looking at the world, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, if it's interesting, if it's, you know, if it interests you, then follow it, because, you know, you never know what you're going to stumble into.
Yeah.
And that's as far as like movies, art, and life, and just following Trent around and getting to know him a little bit. That's just kind of how he works. And he's a really fun guy to be around, because he's kind of unpredictable. But usually ends up at a place that's, you know, that you never would have gotten to unless you had taken that strange turn.
Right. And another thing you reveal about Trent, and I'm glad you do, is that I think a lot of people perceive him as kind of this iconoclastic curmudgeon, but you really sort of reveal the soft side of Trent Harris, and his soft spot for Cambodia. I mean, that's another part of the film that I wanted you to say something about.
Yeah, I mean, that was all very eye-opening, and how my documentary about the Beaver Trilogy ended up in Cambodia, I'm not quite sure, but it was, but it happened. I mean, in a way, Trent saying, "Listen to your visitors," it probably wasn't actually this, but it was him, you know, winking at me, saying, "Follow me. Mm-hmm. You don't need to make your documentary. I'll tell you what to do and where to go." And so, we had kind of this wild misadventure that took us way off course of the story of the Beaver Trilogy, but in a way kind of explains the Beaver Trilogy by taking us so far off course. And getting to go to Cambodia was a lot of fun. It was really eye-opening. You kind of see the definitely the sweeter side of Trent, and the side that you would never imagine. The guy that's making goofball Reuben and Ed is also making these. He has a 1 hour documentary called The Cement Ball, which is also about Cambodia, and I think that's where he got his kind of initial love and appreciation for that country over there. And I got to go over there and meet his sponsored child, Thet, and to just see kind of it was very eye opening for me, because I was born and raised in Salt Lake City, and going over to Cambodia, it's kind of it really is a different world over there.
Yeah. There's a go ahead. Sorry.
And also Trent is kind of maybe crusty is the right word. He's kind of crusty, but he's also, you know, he'll complain about something. He came out to LA to play the 21st anniversary of Reuben and Ed, and he had this great moment where we're in the car. This isn't in the documentary, but we're in the car, and I'm asking him how it feels to be back in LA. He lived in LA for 13 years and just hates it. So he was back in LA for the first time, and he's driving along, and he's talking about staying at the Standard and how there's all these buff guys, and they're all on their phones and talking really loud and making deals, and how you know, they've got their $200,000 cars, and he's basically on this like 2-minute rant about how the place that he's staying at. But at the very end, he goes,
you know, but it's kind of fun. It's kind of cool.
Right.
And it's that kind of like complain, but I'm kind of liking it at the same time.
Yeah.
I think that kind of, you know, sums up Trent a little bit.
Let me play one more clip from the film because he raises a question that I wanted to ask of you. And he's talking to you at this particular moment and asking that big question about why anyone does art and, you know, why do you do it?
Why in the hell do you do it? You know, why do you do it? I mean, it's, you know, you can ask yourself the same question you're asking me. You know, why have you gone to all this trouble to come here and film me? It doesn't make sense. I mean, you're not going to make a dime. Are you guys kidding me? You're not going to make a dime off this film. Are you insane? This is probably even a worse idea than I've come up with. I mean, <yeah. laughs> in terms of absolutely no commercial potential, you have reached the pinnacle. I mean, there's a lot of me blabbering and a lot of my friends blabbering, but I can't see any dramatic arc at all. Unless I die or win the lottery or get elected president, you don't really have a story.
That was a very terrifying moment because I had my camera crew in London for some unknown reason following the premiere of Luna Mesa.
Right.
And it didn't go quite according to plan. And so that was in my head going into it. That was going to be the final interview. And in the final interview, Trent was just kind of unloading on us that, you know, we should ask ourselves those questions and that kind of stuff. And when I was getting that response, I was just wide-eyed and had no idea what to do with it. But later on, I realized that it's kind of a really valuable piece of footage.
Yeah. Brett Besser directed the documentary film Beaver Trilogy Part 4. Next Wednesday, we're screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Brad will be back from London, part of the Q&A. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center, and for some reason, Trent Harris has agreed to be with us. He's a good sport, so he'll be there for the Q&A after the film as well. So you should join us. We'll put details on our website. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
It'll be fun.
We'll talk to you next week. I should also mention Trent Harris's Plan 10 from Outer Space has been remastered for the 20th anniversary. That's going to be opening at the Salt Lake Film Society's Tower Theater on March 11th. We have details about all of that, again, on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Sophie Sirwa is our intern. Josh Weathers is the producer of Video West, Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.